You're listening to an Airwave Media Podcast.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Forget the frustration of picking commerce platforms when you switch your business to Shopify, the global commerce platform that supercharges your selling wherever you sell. With Shopify, you'll harness the same intuitive features, trusted apps, and powerful analytics used by the world's leading brands. Sign up today for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/tech, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/tech.
This is Kick-Ass News. I'm Ben Mathis. Today's episode is brought to you by Kronos. Kronos provides HR solutions for the modern workforce and the people who support, motivate, and engage them. They put HR, payroll, talent, and timekeeping on a single cloud-based platform. Learn more about Kronos HR Payroll Talent and Time at kronos.com/HR Swagger. That's kronos.com/HR Swagger. And now, on with the show. Hi, I'm Ben Mathis. Welcome to Kick-Ass News. Silicon Valley icon Guy Kawasaki has been a fixture in the tech world since he was part of Apple's original Macintosh team in the 80s. He served as chief evangelist for Macintosh for 4 years and was brought back to revive the Mac brand when Steve Jobs returned to Apple in the 90s. These days, Guy is a best-selling author, chief evangelist for Canva, a graphic design website, brand ambassador for Mercedes-Benz, and a leading expert on business strategy and marketing, speaking to sold-out audiences all over the world and young aspiring entrepreneurs as an executive fellow at the Haas School of Business at UC Berkeley. But before all that, he was just a middle-class kid in Hawaii, a grandson of Japanese immigrants who loved football and got a C+ in ninth grade English. And now, in his most personal book yet, Guy shares some stories and advice covering everything from moral values to business schools to parenting. The book is called Wise Guy, Lessons from a Life, and today Guy Kawasaki joins me on the podcast to talk about it. He reminisces about his childhood growing up in Hawaii and his father, who loved jazz music so much that he named his son after big band leader Guy Lombardo. He recalls getting his start in the jewelry business, why he says selling diamonds was much harder than selling computers, and how the skills he learned in the jewelry trade came in surprisingly handy when he became chief evangelist for Macintosh. He talks about personally witnessing the dark side and the genius of Apple founder Steve Jobs. He shares what he calls the gospel according to Steve, but also cautions aspiring tech moguls not to try to emulate this singular visionary. Guy opens up about the argument with Jobs that led him to quit Apple in the 90s and reveals the costliest job that he ever turned down. He talks about honor and honesty in the tech industry, his litmus test for whether he wants to do business with someone, and why many of the best deals he ever made in his life were only done on a handshake. He shares plenty of sage marketing advice, including what he calls Guy's Golden Rule, and he gives me a crash course on how to be a social media influencer without letting it take over your life. Plus, the costly mistake Hillary Clinton made with Silicon Valley, a cost-benefit analysis of standing up to Donald Trump, and two Asian celebrities Guy always gets mistaken for. Coming up with Guy Kawasaki in just a moment. Guy Kawasaki has been a fixture in the tech world since he was part of Apple's original Macintosh team back in the 80s. He served as the chief evangelist for Apple and special advisor to the CEO of Motorola Business Unit at Google, Today, Guy Kawasaki is the chief evangelist for Canva, an online design service, brand ambassador for Mercedes-Benz, and an executive fellow at the Haas School of Business at the University of California, Berkeley. He's the author of the best-selling books The Art of the Start and Enchantment, and widely respected as a source of wisdom about entrepreneurship, venture capital, marketing, and business evangelism. Now he's sharing what he's learned in his latest book titled Wise Guy, Lessons from a Life. Guy Kawasaki, thanks for joining me.
Thank you. Appreciate the opportunity.
You say that this is your most personal book yet. You get into your family history, mm-hmm. your childhood growing up in Hawaii, and your family's immigration from Japan. Did they come over before or after World War II?
They came over before.
Before, okay.
Yes. So I'm third generation Japanese American, and I was born in 1954. So my father was there. As I said, third. So
okay, was it as bad in Hawaii with the internment camps as it was here in California?
No, not at all. Not at all. Well, first of all, I wasn't alive, so I couldn't tell you. But
right.
basically, I would say there's probably too many Japanese to put them in camps in Hawaii. It'd be easier to put the white people in the camp. Than the, so the Japanese American youth experience in Hawaii versus mainland United States is very different. Mm-hmm. Very, very different.
Your dad apparently named you after the big band leader Guy Lombardo, one of the little tidbits in this book. I don't know if anyone listening is going to have any reference whatsoever for Guy Lombardo anymore. I mean, that's going back a ways, but what's the story there?
Well, Guy Lombardo was a big band leader out of Canada, and my father was a big jazz fan and jazz musician, so he knew Guy Lombardo, Guy and Carmen Lombardo, and he named me after Guy instead of Carmen.
Now, did your dad try to turn you into a musician too?
I must admit, he never tried. It's too bad. I wish he tried harder. I wish I had listened, but no, he didn't.
Yeah, in the book, I think you say something along the lines of, you know, you're not the type of parent who pushes a sport or an instrument on your children.
Quite
you end
opposite.
Up adopting the sport that they're into, right?
Yeah, so, one son took up hockey, I took up hockey. Daughter took up surfing, I took up surfing.
Do you like it?
Surfing?
Yeah.
Surfing has changed my life.
Really?
I spend more time surfing than anything else in my life.
Wow. Well, what is it about? I've never surfed in my life. What is it
about it?
It's
the most fun you can have
so
without being illegal. it's hard to describe. It's just a rush. You're on a wave and you're moving at speed. And it's very hard, though.
Yeah.
I mean, don't get me wrong. I think it's harder than skiing. Mm-hmm. So I think it's harder than hockey also.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Is it relaxing? Does it help you decompress? No.
Depends how much you're into it, but I wouldn't say it's a zen-like experience for a beginner because there are so many variables. I mean, there's the board, there's the wave, there's the wind, there's the tide, there are other people in the water.
Yeah.
There's a lot of variables.
Of course, you didn't start till when? 64,
I started at 62, which is 62. About 58 years too late. But
Well, never too late, I guess.
in my case, I don't know. That's debatable.
Now, in talking about your early life, you say that you didn't have exactly perfect grades in school, but you were lucky enough to have a teacher who was a big influence on you. And I have to say, that's a commonality that I find with a lot of success stories that I've interviewed over the years. They always seem to have some type of teacher who made a big impact. Mm-hmm. Who was that for you?
This teacher was an English teacher at Iolani School in Hawaii. His name was Harold Keebles. He was the toughest teacher. Steve Jobs was the toughest boss.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
I had a similar experience. One of my most influential teachers was an English teacher, and him with the Oxford comma things that still are just beat into me to this very day.
I had the same experience. Thing? We would write essays and he would find every mistake and he would circle it. And then you'd have to write it as you'd had incorrectly, cite the rule that you broke and then write it correctly.
Yeah.
So,
it's funny because it seems to me that it's always the strictest teachers who end up being the biggest influences.
Although at the time,
yeah,
that's not how you look at it.
Yeah. Now, you went on to college at Stanford?
Yes.
Yeah, Stanford, yes. And then briefly flirted with going into law.
Very right? briefly.
Two weeks of law school.
Yeah. Maybe it was a week, but yeah. It wasn't a semester, I guarantee you that.
What happened? Just what
just
made you decide
it.
You...
I just hated really? It. And I first time I quit anything in my life.
Is there a lesson there about knowing when to quit?
Well, the lesson is that...
When to move on?
I think a lot of people are just deathly afraid of quitting because they think the first time they quit, it's a downward spiral and mm-hmm. you become a quitter.
Yeah.
That's not my experience, obviously. So I quit one thing. I don't know if I ever quit anything again. I think for parents, your kids have to live their own life. And if they want to quit law school, they quit law school. I mean, I don't know how much you can force them into doing anything.
Yeah.
At some point, it's going to bite you in the butt.
Yeah. And after school, you went from selling jewelry to going to the tech industry, eventually becoming chief evangelist for Macintosh back in the 80s. How did you make that huge leap? That's
nepotism.
Not a logical progression.
It's nepotism.
Nepotism.
My Stanford roommate, a guy named Mike Boych, hired me into Apple because honestly I had, I don't know about wrong, but irrelevant background in terms of education and work experience. I worked in the jewelry business. I had a psych major. You know, it's not exactly what you would call prime for tech.
Yeah. Now, you say that the jewelry business was actually way harder than the tech industry.
Yes.
That's saying a hell of a lot. what made it so much tougher?
The jewelry business is, it's not a high growth business.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all built on personal selling and trust. You know, none of this like, you know, A-B testing with the Google homepage. Does a blue link work better than a green link kind of thing? It was hand-to-hand combat.
Yeah.
But that lesson was very valuable for the rest of my life because I think in life, you're either making something or you're selling something.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what it comes down to. And it really helped me to learn how to sell.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. What were some of the aspects of that first job that translated to sales and marketing at Macintosh?
Well, mostly that it was about trust. It was about empathy for your customer. It was about, you know, when you say you're going to get a ring out for a special occasion, you've got to get the ring out. I mean, there's a lot of, it was real analog stuff.
But it still matters. That stuff still counts.
To this day, yes, absolutely.
Yeah. And you were there when Macintosh really developed into a cult, long before Apple developed into a cult, just a couple decades later. What was the secret to creating such fanatical enthusiasm for Macintosh and then the broader Apple brand later on? Is it as simple as just having a great product, or is there more to it than that?
Well, in one sense, it is that simple.
Mm-hmm.
I think that great products develop cult followings, at least loyal followings. So that's what I call Guy's Golden Touch. Guy's Golden Touch is not that whatever I touch turns to gold. Guy's Golden Touch is whatever's gold Guy touches.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was able to touch Macintosh. Now I'm touching Canva. I truly do believe that 90% of it is the product because it's very hard to get people to love crap. So it's very easy to get them to love something great. And if they do love something great, they're a lot more forgiving about everything else.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. You say the second adopter is the first customer. What do you mean by that?
Well, the concept here is that maybe you love something. Maybe your founders and co-founders love something. But the real test is not that you love something. It's that you can get somebody else to believe in it. And that's the second or third customer. That's the hard one.
Well, I have to ask you about Steve. Was he as demanding a boss as people say?
Yes, he was.
Tough guy. Absolutely. Huh?
Tough guy. High standards. It wasn't impolite. I don't think there's such a word, but he was apolite.
Yeah.
You know, he wasn't impolite or polite. He was apolite. It just didn't occur to him. He was just what he was.
Right. He was one of those singularly focused visionaries.
You'd say he's on the spectrum. So my observation is people on the spectrum make the best entrepreneurs. So that's a good thing.
Him
in Silicon Valley.
Microsoft, Bill Gates, right? I think he supposedly is autistic.
I don't know about that. But
I think I had read that somewhere.
Listen, there are not a lot of high school quarterbacks and homecoming queens who have started tech companies, let's just say.
Okay. But you were a high school, not a quarterback, but you played football.
I loved football, but it's not like I'm Tom Brady or anything.
Yeah.
So, I love football. To me, it was all about hard work and overcoming a lack of talent, which is, that's what life is about.
Yeah. And in here you have Steve's 11 commandments or something like that, or the gospel according to Steve. Is that right?
Yes.
What are the key ones there?
that your current customers aren't very good at telling you how to revolutionize the business.
Mm-hmm.
They can only tell you they want better, faster, cheaper, sameness. So better, faster, cheaper Apple II as opposed to a Macintosh. Or better, faster, cheaper Macintosh as opposed to iPhone, iPod, iPad.
Yeah.
And so today we can tell Apple, yeah, I want a better, faster, cheaper iPhone, iPod, iPad, but we can't tell them the next curve.
Mm-hmm.
And so that comes from vision and passion and luck.
Yeah. How much of it was luck, do you think?
You can't say that Steve was just a lucky guy, because
right.
he was lucky too many times in a row, right?
Yeah.
So he had
mm-hmm.
Apple I, Apple II, Macintosh, iOS. And even within those, there are things like he embraced CD-ROMs in every computer, right?
That's right.
FireWire.
Yeah.
Over and over again, even at the little minutia level, as well as the big jumps, he called it. I mean, he wasn't 100%, but most people would be lucky to have invented or created the Apple I or Apple II or Macintosh or iOS.
Mm-hmm. Sure.
He did four. I mean, you know, how many people have done four things? Not that many.
Yeah. Yeah. Lightning doesn't usually strike twice.
So I don't think it was luck.
Yeah.
In the history of American business, to use the V word, visionary, there haven't been that many. So, Edison, Jobs, Disney, Musk.
Yeah.
No, that's it.
You think that's it?
In that category, at that level, yeah.
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 What do you think of Elon now? He's had a rough year. Think of him as a visionary?
You know what? Steve had a rough year. Steve, got fired from Apple. He went to Next. Next kind of imploded. You know, he sold it back to Apple. I would not short Tesla.
Oh, really?
At all. No.
Okay.
No. Those kind of people, they just have a way of surviving.
You know, there's no shortage of aspiring Steve Jobses out there, but I think in an interview I read you say...
What do you mean?
No shortage of aspiring Steve Jobses.
Yes.
Not Steve Jobses.
So
but I think I read in an interview where you said people should not try to be Steve.
No.
Why not?
Well, first of all, I would debate whether you should try to be somebody else at all. Anybody else, right? So right there, we just eliminated everybody. But Steve in particular, I think that he was a unique individual and he could either foretell the future or he could just make whatever the hell he wanted and convince everybody that that was the future. Either skill is pretty priceless.
Yeah.
So to think that, you know, you're going to be the next Steve Jobs, well, somebody tried to do that in the analysis of blood, let's just say.
That's true.
So there's several issues. One is that's a standard that maybe nobody can ever achieve. Mm-hmm. Secondly, you know, how can you go through life saying, oh, yeah, you know, I wanted to be the next Steve Jobs. And, you know, you should be the first of whatever you are as opposed to the second Steve Jobs. And the third thing is, I think many people have a difficulty separating correlation from causation.
Mm-hmm.
And so from the outside, you look and say, okay, I'll buy a black mock turtleneck. I'll buy New Balance shoes.
Apart,
I'll wear, you know, 501 Levi's.
Mm-hmm.
I'll drive a Mercedes, but I won't register it. I'll park in a handicap spot and I'll drive in, you know, the carpool lane by myself and I'll be the next Steve Jobs. No, you won't. You'll just be the next jerk.
Now, you left Apple twice. The first time to start up a company of your own.
Yep.
And the second time you say you left over an argument with Steve about the iconic Apple Think campaign.
Well, no. No.
That's
not
it was
accurate.
During that.
I left both times to start companies.
Okay.
It just happens that the second time, it was a marketing meeting of all the marketing managers and above. And the Think Different campaign was presented to us. And at the end of that meeting, the agency person said, I have two copies of what I just showed you. I'll give you one, Steve, and I'll give one to Guy. And Steve said, don't give one to Guy. And so I said... What's the matter, Steve? Don't you trust me? And he said, yes, I don't trust you. And I said, that's okay, Steve. I don't trust you either.
So, wow.
Probably cost me $250 million right there.
Yeah. Man. Was he serious? He wasn't joking, was he?
I don't think he was joking, but again...
Is he just razzing you?
No, I mean, that was him. He was a WYSIWYG kind of guy.
Yeah.
You know, he didn't...
Wow.
I don't think that was evil, or that was just his way of,
yeah.
You know, if he thought you were crap, he told you you were crap. He wouldn't, you know, he wouldn't say, well, you have lots of potential. You're shit.
Yeah. Any regrets about leaving, you know, right there in the late 90s, just before Steve and Apple made the big comeback?
You mean other than leaving a $1 trillion company twice?
Sure. Well, yeah, no, there's no, that.
Yeah, there's that. I mean, yeah. So what's a few hundred million between friends?
Sure. Now, apparently leaving Apple wasn't the biggest mistake that you ever made in your career. You once turned down a chance to become CEO of Yahoo.
Yes.
That's well, got to I mean, be a way costly back when. Mistake.
Yeah.
Right.
Not lately.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, I figure that's probably $2 billion.
$2
billion. So,
but back then, you know, who knew? Where Yahoo was going to go, right?
Well, yeah. I mean, well, who knew where Apple was going to go? I mean, everybody thought Apple's in the toilet, so who knew where Yahoo was going to go? I mean, who knew?
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe I should go join Theranos right now. I mean, who knows?
Yeah, I think you said that Steve tried to hire you back to Apple.
Yeah,
a third
it was
time.
A third strike.
What was the
I'm
offer?
I'm just a loser.
You take it.
He wanted me to run Apple University, which is internal training for Apple employees. Yeah. If I had not quit either of those two times or taken that job, I wouldn't be sitting here in this room in LA right now doing a podcast.
Yeah, yeah. That may be a good thing. I don't know.
Hope it's good for you.
But do you, well, it's definitely good for me. Well, who knows? Do you think you would have been as happy if you had stayed at Apple?
I don't know. That's a good
you
question.
Seem like a pretty happy guy.
I'm
to
a very
me.
Happy guy you seem considering like I passed on $2.35 billion. But yeah, you don't have to cry for me.
Yeah.
It's not like I'm a billionaire or anything, but I have, you know, I'm on wife 1.0 and I have four great children. And so, you know, it depends on how you count.
Mm-hmm. We're going to take a quick break and then I'll be back with more with Guy Kawasaki when we come back in just a minute. Hey folks, it's summer, and summer is prime ice cream season. In fact, that may be one of my favorite things about summer, because a hot summer day makes for the perfect excuse to indulge in a frosty treat from Ben & Jerry's. When I'm by the pool or barbecuing, nothing cools me down or satisfies my sweet tooth like a scoop of Ben & Jerry's chocolate chip cookie dough. Or two, or maybe even three on a really hot one. And here's a little advice. Don't eat it as soon as you get it out of the refrigerator. Let it sit for a couple of minutes and soften up so you can really dig in there and get some cookie dough in every bite. Summer and Ben & Jerry's. At my house, the two go hand in hand. Treat yourself to your favorite flavor anywhere ice cream's sold or find a new favorite at benjerry.com. That's benjerry.com. And now, back to the podcast. Now, you know, we're just talking about the issue of trust.
Yes.
You know, I have to wonder if that comes up much in the industry, because the tech industry has this reputation for being so cutthroat, and there are all these stories of companies stealing other companies' ideas.
Yeah.
Is there a place for morals and ethics in that business?
One would hope.
Mm-hmm.
My experience is it's not as dark as you would think.
Yeah.
It's not as people at Facebook and Google and Apple are, you know, plotting to just victimize the world. I don't think so. I think at the core, Apple was founded to make people more creative and productive.
Mm-hmm.
Google was to access information. Canva is to democratize design. I really don't think the origins and even the current operation is heinous. Now, at any given moment, any of those companies may do something that you would consider heinous, but it's also subject to how the journalists view something, right?
Mm-hmm.
So you have to hear both sides of this.
Yeah. Yeah. And you seem like a guy who has tried as best you can to live your life with integrity and be trustworthy and upfront with people. And you talk about that in the book. I was surprised, in fact, to learn how many deals you've made on a handshake or just on someone's word over the years.
I've made.
And with some pretty big companies, too.
Only the best ones went like that. Yeah, I have had handshake deals or just oral agreements or not even any agreements.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it's several things. So first of all, it's not because I have this, you know, enormous amount of power so they don't dare screw me.
Mm-hmm.
That's not why. It's more that I delivered or over-delivered and that they were trustworthy and honest people from the start. So I picked, maybe out of luck, I picked good people to work with I did good work for them. And so without paperwork and contracts and all that, but it wasn't because I was holding a gun to their head.
Yeah.
It was,
yeah.
It was never the, have a gun. I mean,
yeah. You say something I think that's pretty wise in here. You say, I'd rather do a handshake deal with someone who's honest than have a written contract with someone who's not honest.
Yeah.
Because I mean, they can always still take you to court. Donald Trump's proven that.
Yeah. Know? Oh, yeah.
Have there been times when you've trusted someone or done a handshake deal and gotten screwed, though?
Two speaking agencies have screwed me.
Really?
Where they've taken the money that clients have paid them and never paid me and disappeared.
Oh, really?
Yeah, so that's happened twice in my
never
life.
Never made it to you, huh?
Never made it. The way the speaking business works is the client, you know, whoever has the conference or whatever, pays the agency. Mm-hmm. The agency pays the speaker after the speech is made.
Right.
And so what's supposed to happen is it protects both sides because the agency will have a hard time collecting after a speech because what leverage do you have?
Mm-hmm.
And the agency doesn't want to give it to the speaker because once you give it to the speaker, what leverage do you have on the speaker saying, you know, you really better show up. We're not paying you in advance. But it means that the agency is kind of the escrow.
Right.
And if the escrow disappears, then you're screwed.
Yeah.
And it at the extreme, you know, there was a case where the agency disappeared for a speech that had not yet happened.
Oh, interesting.
So the client had paid the agency. The agency had not paid me because I hadn't given the speech. So I had to get on a plane and give a speech knowing I would never be paid.
Really? Why did you do that?
Well, because A, it's not the client's fault.
Okay.
Right? The client did what they're supposed to do, pay the agency.
Right.
And B, no matter how much I explain it, at the end of the day, client can say, we paid for a guy and he didn't show up.
Mm-hmm.
I can't build a case that that's going to help me.
Yeah. It's not the agent's reputation that's on the line here.
It's
yours.
Yeah, absolutely.
It's your butt on the line.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Now, you have developed what you call some litmus tests for determining whether someone is a person that you want to do business with or not. How do you make those kind of judgment calls?
One has to understand, whenever you ask somebody a question like that, and they tell you that, you know, I have this inherent sense, or it's because of years of experience, or all that kind of stuff, it's BS, okay?
Yeah.
Because, quite frankly, I think there's a self-selection process where I only remember the times and talk about the times where I was right.
Uh-huh, of course.
And I don't remember times when I was screwed and I was wrong. Although clearly I just proved to you that I do remember that.
Yeah.
So I'm not 100%, but I'm pretty close.
Mm-hmm.
But I will tell you that, yeah, I have been screwed. I mean, but only those two times really. And not so much that it's affected my psyche, because I think what happens when you get screwed, you flip the other way,
mm-hmm.
and now you're like totally legalistic. You're trying to always cover the downside.
Yeah.
You assume everybody's bad until proven good. And if you go through life thinking that everybody's bad until proven good, you're going to have a pathetic life.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, yeah. There's a miserable way to go through life.
Yeah. And you will pass on opportunities, and opportunities will, you know, pass on you because of that attitude.
Mm-hmm.
My attitude is, listen, just keep saying yes to everything and sort it out later.
Yeah. It seems to have worked out well.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I want to say that you have something called the shopping center test or the shopping mall test for whether you want to spend time on people or not.
So the shopping center test is you go to a shopping center and you see somebody that's interviewing at your company or, you know, whatever you just met, and that person has not yet seen you. So at that point, you can rush over and say hello. You can say, well, if I get face-to-face to this person, I'll say hello. Or you can get in the car and go to another shopping center.
Mm-hmm.
So my test for people is, if I had just met you and I see you at a shopping center, I should want to just make a beeline right over to see you. And if you don't pass that test, then says everything,
so,
right?
Yeah. So in every interaction, you envision yourself in the shopping center.
I don't know about every interaction. That's a little much.
Okay.
But, you know, I'm sure
you wouldn't want to run into me in a shopping center.
I would. But
I'd see you going out the door, I'm sure, from across the way.
But I bet you seriously that how many people have you interviewed in a podcast?
Oh, God. I think like 400 or 500 now.
Okay.
400,
so,
somewhere around there.
You can't tell me that if you saw all 500, not obviously at once, but if you went to shopping center 500 times and each time you saw one of them, would you make a beeline for every one of them?
Oh, God. No, you know, in fact, I have had this chance several times, and there have been times when I've
just like,
I've just held back. Yeah, yeah.
So that's the test.
Yeah, that's true.
So I hope if you see me, you'll come up to me.
Oh, I absolutely will.
What are you going to say?
No. Yes, yes. You know, now that I come to think about it, probably in most of the cases where I have run into people, I think I've tried to avoid them first.
Shopping center wasn't big enough?
Shopping center was not big enough. That's right. Well, you know, it's funny because I don't think of you as a political guy, but you do get into politics in this book a little bit.
Yeah.
You talk about having supported Hillary Clinton in 2016
and
how you tried to help her campaign but got shot down. And apparently this happened not just to you, but also there were similar stories from Facebook and Microsoft as well.
Yep.
Didn't want a lot of tech help, a lot of social media help. Do you think this says something about the broader problems with that campaign?
Well, I mean, I'm on the outside looking in, right? And it could be my egocentricity that says, you know, how dare they not accept my help?
Yeah.
So maybe it's my problem, but I just relate some stories where I offered to help, and, you know, particularly in social media, and my contact told me, well, we think we have it all wired. Okay. And I know people at Microsoft and Facebook who said, yeah, we tried to help the Clinton campaign, but they said, no, you know, we got it wired. Well, I don't know if I had helped and they had taken the help of Facebook and Microsoft, you know, that she would have won.
Well, I know. We might be living in a very different world,
I mean, you know, maybe we would be supporting asylum seekers and maybe we wouldn't be near war with Iran.
You might be Secretary of Commerce. Who knows?
Yeah. I mean, what a concept. Yeah. I mean, maybe there would be such a thing as science and truth. And, you know,
would be nice.
What a concept. I mean.
Well, what about the other one? Do you know Trump? I have to think that your paths must have crossed in the speaking circuit
crossed,
and all that.
Well, I certainly didn't get any dressing rooms with him, but many, many years ago, just like faint memory of Trump University liked one of my books or something like that.
Really?
I've never met the man. I've never done anything that I can remember. Certainly, if people follow me on social media, they know exactly where I stand on this issue.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, definitely. Definitely.
And you know, what I don't understand is why more people don't take a stand. Knock on wood, it doesn't come to, you know, the end of democracy and all that. But if it did, well, at least I can say, well, I tried to resist. Mm-hmm. You know, what did you other social media influencers do?
Yeah.
You were afraid to take a stand because you might lose followers on Instagram?
Definitely.
What BS is that?
Yeah.
Right? I mean, and all of this came about because in November of 2016, I went to Germany and I met some friends and they said, you know what? To this day, we're wondering, what the hell were our grandparents thinking? You know, how did they let Hitler come to power? And right now, it is your time in America. If your grandchildren ask you, did you resist Trump? Do you want to say, well, no, I didn't because I didn't want to lose any followers?
Yeah.
I mean, that's pathetic.
Yeah. When all of this washes out and it's all said and done, I think there are going to be a lot of Republicans who are going to have a lot to answer for. A lot of people in the media. It's not going to be pretty.
It may take 10 or 20 years, right? But you can't tell me that history will look back and say Mitch McConnell was a great senator.
Yeah.
And Paul Ryan was a patriot. Mike Pence did a real great. I mean, it's just not going to be happening, right? And evangelical Christians, holy cow, I don't understand that at all. I mean, that is just...
Yeah, I mean, I've never seen people sell out their own values so quickly or their own purported values so quickly.
For one
even
issue,
even if I don't always agree with them.
Yeah. It's a tricky thing because... You know, I've kind of secularized the term evangelism.
Yeah, that's funny.
And I have to... Okay, so here's the irony. So when I first was a secular evangelist, there was this religious connotation. People say, well, you're an evangelist. Isn't that something like Christian thing? That was, you know, back in the 80s, right?
Yeah.
But then, you know, it became secular and blah, blah, blah. Now, I feel the opposite way that...
Are you running away from the term evangelist now?
Well, I certainly make it clear to people that there is a big difference between evangelistic and evangelical.
Oh, right. Yeah.
Because
that's a big distinction.
That is a huge, but not everybody gets that. Mm-hmm.
How do you define a secular evangelist? For people like my parents who may not know what that means.
Well, evangelism comes from a Greek word meaning bringing the good news.
Mm-hmm.
So a religious evangelist, brings the good news of eternal life through accepting Christ.
Okay.
Well,
you bring the good news of Macintosh or Canva.
Yeah, so the secular evangelist
talks
about eternal life through Macintosh and Canva.
What do you think of Trump as a businessman? Does he have the right to proclaim himself this real estate genius and this huge success?
Doesn't seem like that to me. I mean, I guess we'd know if his tax returns came out. No, I don't think so.
Yeah. When you came out publicly against Trump, did you get a lot of trouble from your supporters or your followers on Twitter?
Well,
was that controversial?
It depends how you define a lot, right?
So
at any given moment, I had, I don't know, 10 or 12 million followers, and who knows how many were active. So that's an inflated number.
And how many were Russian?
How many were Russian bots and all that? So, you know, like some people were hitting me with the logic like, oh, you're just antagonizing half of your customer base. I don't think so. I don't think, you know, like a lot of white nationalists are my customer base. I don't, you know.
Yeah.
And with hindsight, I will tell you that I think that I built stronger relationships with the people who were my followers because they saw that I would take a stand.
Yeah.
And I don't know of any circumstance where it has cost me money. Right. It's not like, oh, you know, the NRA was going to use me for a keynote speaker and they changed their mind. Well, I wouldn't have accepted that anyway.
Yeah.
So I can't tell you that I think it cost me anything. Yeah, and even if it did cost me something, you know, some companies wouldn't hire me because I was so political. Well, again, we go back to this thing like, you know, at the end of your life or, you know, as your grandchildren remember you. You want them to say, okay, so Grandpa didn't fight Trump because he wouldn't get hired by XYZ Corporation to speak. And that's why we live in a totalitarian society today, right? I mean, that's
bigger
just
things.
Not acceptable.
Mm-hmm. Speaking of social media, you have, I think, 10 million followers
on
social media. You also have some wisdom in this book about how to use social media, how not to get in trouble on social media. What are some of your rules?
Well, the first rule is always provide value. So I think that's the key to social media. So you provide value by entertaining people, informing people, helping them with analysis, you know, whatever it is. Curation. So I look at dozens of stories every day and I post 10 of them, you know, something like that. So I act as a curator as opposed to a creator. And so you have to add value. And if you add value, you earn the right to then use social media as a marketing platform, which is what I do. I mean, I make no bones about it. I'm not on social media to make friends.
Mm-hmm.
I have one wife, four kids, a dog, and I love to surf. I don't want any more friends. Yeah. I think there's some theoretical limit of 150 friends. I think I can handle about 20. So I'm full up.
Yeah. You're very good at it, though, I have to say. And me, on the other hand, I'm terrible at Twitter.
Oh, it's because we're politically aligned. You'd say I was terrible at social media if we weren't.
Oh, yeah, I don't know. Maybe, but probably not. I mean, I tend to treat social media, and especially Twitter, as a distraction more than a tool.
Yeah.
Don't you find it distracting or annoying to constantly feed that beast?
I can fix your problem.
Okay, please help me out.
I feed the beast. I don't eat the beast.
Okay.
So I literally, on all social media platforms, other than Instagram, where I look at surfing feeds, I never read.
Oh, really?
I never consume. I only post.
So it's a one-way street.
It's one-way street.
Okay.
I'm like antisocial. So, you know, I post my 10 stories every day. I read the comments. I block people who, like, you know, are all pissed off, so I don't have to deal with them.
Mm-hmm.
I don't read what's trending on Twitter. I don't read any of those things. I follow very few people. And
how many?
You mean if I were to add
up? Sorry to put you on the spot. There.
No,
let's say on Twitter. Just on Twitter.
Guess.
We're talking 25, 50, under 100?
I would say if you added up all my platforms, how many people I follow? Under 1,000.
Really? Still, that's pretty good. 1,000.
But okay, so I may follow, let's say I follow 1,000 on these.
Well, I mean, 1,000 out of 10 million is not a lot.
But even though I follow 1,000, which may seem like a large number, I never read their posts. I never read their posts.
I hope they're not listening.
They never read my posts.
Yeah.
So,
oh, really?
Okay. So for example, when I go to LinkedIn
and
I look at the timeline,
uh-huh.
I check LinkedIn to see what's happening on my posts,
uh-huh.
Not what anybody else posts. There's only one guy on LinkedIn that I love. His name, I think, is Tom Fishburne, and he has a very, very sarcastic business cartoon series.
Okay.
But other than that...
So then why do you follow them if you don't read their stuff? I'm just curious.
Well...
Or is it just out of a courtesy thing?
Okay, on Instagram, I follow him because I love surfing.
I don't mean him in general. The people that you follow. Yeah. If you don't read their stuff, why do you follow? I'm just curious.
Because way back when, years ago, I thought it would be valuable to follow them.
Okay. For the relationship?
No. Okay. For the information.
Oh, okay.
So let's take someone like Richard Branson. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I follow Richard Branson. I can't tell you I ever like now hang on his every post and all that. Yeah. I just don't consume. I'm like a drug dealer who doesn't take drugs.
Okay.
How's that?
Okay, that's perfect.
Because I realize it, drugs can ruin your life.
Yeah.
So I don't take drugs, but I push them.
Okay. That's the perfect analogy.
I don't know if that's a perfect analogy. I'm not a drug dealer.
Well, okay. Yeah.
But I don't consume
I get what you're saying. Yeah. Yeah. See, my problem is that I have a problem just creating that much content and having to put that stuff out there.
Well, but I mean,
especially when it's personal, you know?
No, but... So your expertise is, how would you define your expertise?
Oh God, stealing other people's expertise, just like I'm doing right now.
Okay, so, but that's the good definition of a curator.
Okay.
Right?
All right, fair
so
enough.
You could build up a social media following because you have the reputation of you cherry pick the right story from Wired, Fast Company, USA Today, Inc., Entrepreneur, Harvard Business Review.
Yeah.
I'm assuming business, right?
Yeah.
If I follow you, I will see great stories. I don't have to try to read Harvard Business Review, Wired, Fast Company, Verge, TechCrunch. I mean, I don't have to read 20 public. I just follow you.
Okay.
That's a value.
Okay. All right. I'll see what I can do with that.
Okay.
Now, you know, as we wind down here, I have to ask about the person you most get mistaken for.
Jackie Chan? Or Robert Kiyosaki?
Well, is it Jackie Chan or is it the author?
It's really Robert Kiyosaki. Because once a week, somebody comes up to me and says, your book changed my life. I had no direction. I didn't know what I would do with my life. And your book changed my life. And I say, well, which one of my 15 books changed your life? And he said, Rich Dad, Poor Dad. Happens all the time. Swear to God.
That's
happens
funny.
All the time. People come up to me with the Rich Dad, Poor Dad, ask me to autograph it.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Have you?
Yeah.
You sign it? Do you sign
my
it?
Name.
Guy? Yeah. That's great.
I sign it, Poor Dad, Poor Dad.
Love it. Well, I could end by asking you what's the most important lesson that you've learned, but I think I'll just, you probably get that all the time. So I'll ask you, what's the hardest lesson that you've learned over your life?
The hardest one, business lesson,
is
probably that the best widget doesn't necessarily win.
The best widget doesn't necessarily win.
I mean, I think Macintosh is far superior to Windows, and there are many more Windows machines.
Yeah. Right? Yeah.
I still can't wrap my mind around that. So
that's why we need evangelists.
I guess so, but you know, you can only do so much.
Yeah. Well, again, the book is called Wise Guy, Lessons from a Life. Guy Kawasaki, thanks so much for talking with me.
Thank you.
Thanks again to Guy Kawasaki for coming on the show. Order his book, Wise Guy, Lessons from Life, on Amazon, Audible, or wherever books are sold. Keep up with him at GuyKawasaki.com, on Facebook, or on Twitter at Guy Kawasaki. And I want to give a special shout out to Ted and the folks at Live Talks LA for hosting our interview. Live Talks is the speaker series that brings some of the most interesting authors and public figures to Los Angeles. Upcoming guests include Malcolm Gladwell, George Will, and Steve Aoki. Visit livetalksla.org to learn more and buy tickets. You know, folks, when my wife and I sit down to binge watch our favorite TV show or catch up on the newest episode, it's always better with a pint of Ben & Jerry's. Her go-to is a real classic, Cherry's Garcia. But for me, it has to either be chocolate chip cookie dough or chocolate fudge brownie. Because really, it's like getting two desserts in one. You get ice cream and cookies or ice cream and brownies. What's not to love about that? And Ben & Jerry's has something for everyone. So cozy up with your favorite flavor, available anywhere ice cream is sold. Or find a new favorite at benjerry.com. That's BenJerry.com. If you like today's episode, I hope you'll subscribe to Kick-Ass News on Apple Podcasts. And while you're there, take a moment to rate and review the podcast. 5-star ratings and detailed reviews are one of the best ways for new listeners to discover the show.
Another great way for you to support the show is to recommend Kick-Ass News to your friends on social media and follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Kick-Ass News Pod. For more fun stuff, visit our website at kickassnews.com and feel free to email me your comments, questions, and suggestions at comments@kickassnews.com. For now, I'm Ben Mathis, and thanks for listening to Kick-Ass News.